Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Lily Gorin with the New Books Network, the New Books and Political Science podcast. Today, I'm joined by John Lovett, the other John Lovett, to talk about the politics of herding cats when congressional leaders fail. And this is published by the University of Michigan Press in 2021. And it is a really, really fascinating study of thinking about congressional leadership, rank and file members, the role of the media, information transfer, and all kinds of other good things, as well as three really fascinating case studies. But I'm going to let John tell us a bit about that. First, I'd like to welcome John Lovett to the New Books podcast and ask him to tell us a little bit about himself and how he came to this project. Hi, John.
Hi, Lily. Thank you again for this opportunity. So, as you mentioned, my name is John Lovett. I was most recently at Wake Forest University. I taught American politics. And this project ended up being sort of the culmination of what started out as my dissertation. Now, my dissertation, it went through many different forms in many different places. And eventually it started out as one idea. That idea kind of changed a bit. That idea kind of moved as these sort of things do from time to time. And eventually I got to the point where I started thinking about this sort of from that sort of perspective and that sort of relationship between members of Congress and the media, and really just kind of running with that idea and thinking about how members can sort of expand out these issues and really try to sort of overcome leadership, and particularly congressional leadership, obviously. And so really, to some extent, it was just kind of the culmination of me thinking through these ideas and this relationship between the media and Congress and sort of how that sort of has a major effect on public policy in general.
And it's a really interesting deep dive into like so many different aspects of that relationship. And I found it not only fascinating and compelling, but beautifully written. And so it's almost a page turner about Congress, which is a strange thing, because I also sort of know some of these stories, but well done. And so I wanted to ask you, you sort of talk about this, in the acknowledgments, and then you go loop back to it also at the end of the book. The deep cut is Jack Kemp. And Jack Kemp seems to also be sort of a bit of a player in aspects of this. Can you talk a little bit about how you got from former Congressman Jack Kemp and also Secretary of Health and Human Services?
I think so, yeah.
I think that's what he was. To essentially this really complex and variegated sort of story about how Congress works.
So really, the dissertation or the sort of second version of this dissertation or various things started with this idea of tax talk and this idea of members of, in particular, sort of influencing the tax process. And of course, Kemp ends up being a central actor here because Kemp basically spends the late 70s pushing anybody who will listen to him to say, we should be sort of cutting the income tax rate. We should be cutting the income tax rate. And he keeps pushing this. And he keeps pushing this. And mind you, one of the things I realized was he had never spent a day on Ways and Means, on the Ways and Means Committee. So he even after He succeeds in 81. He never spends a day on Ways and Means. He does get eventually out to budget, but he never spends any time here. So it's this idea of this individual member of Congress who theoretically has no power in this system. Like, he never, to my knowledge, and I don't think he served a day in the majority during his entire time in the House, because eventually, yeah, because by the time they were in the majority, he was out at that point. And so really, I mean, he's still able to overcome all this. So I started thinking about some, like, okay, so what is really motivating this? And so I ended up talking about this in my dissertation. Unfortunately, it's one of the things that ended up I kind of moved away from, because there's just so much you can write about when it comes to taxes that it's like, it was eventually a story that I couldn't spend a lot of time telling relative to the stories I could tell in the book. And so to some extent, Kemp he's kind of the background figure in all this, because to some extent, it's the sort of general motivation of where everything was moving and how this all worked. And so really, to some extent, he's kind of the ultimate case of where a member can do this. And to some extent, you just need to have everything go to really sort of not even sort of just stop leaders, but be able to get your priorities through. For him, it ends up being to some extent that he's able to convince leaders, or more specifically, Ronald Reagan, of how important this is. And so really, Kemp ends up being, even though I only mentioned him sort of twice in the book, he's really kind of the overarching sort of ultimate success story in terms of not even going beyond the book sort of stopping leaders into actually getting what you want done.
And so, I mean, I didn't mean to bring up Kemp in that he sort of bookends the book, but in talking about how essentially backbenchers or non-leaders, rank and file members of Congress, particularly in the House, are able to either stop the progress of policy or able to get policy done. This is sort of where you're looking at, like, how does that happen? Because we look at the speaker, we look at the majority leader, we look at the minority leader, and we look at, you know, over this period of time that you're focusing on, also the switching back and forth between the parties. So in terms of how does that happen, this is your story. What did you find that was, you know, particularly interesting as you were looking at the story?
I think the big thing, and it's really sort of this question, and it's something that I've thought about a bit, because I think that that individual leaders can and cannot also sort of really do a lot in this process. Because to some extent, one of the questions that I've gotten sometimes about the book has been, oh, well, this is because one leader was particularly better at this than others. And really, it's the institutional structures that have played a major role. Now, I'm not saying that some leaders were not better at this than others. I would say, for example, I mean, kind of thinking about sort of someone like a Nancy Pelosi was much better at keeping her caucus together, even in that sort of circumstance, than say like a Paul Ryan. And to some extent, of course, it's also different times as well. But I think to some extent that we think about that it really is sort of the power of the institutional structures in terms of sort of maybe not necessarily always compelling action, but at least stopping things from overwhelming the system. One of the examples I have in the book comes up in the chapter on agricultural subsidies, where it's freedom to farm, which ends up being sort of the leader priority of the Republicans in the mid-90s, ends up initially failing in the House Ag Committee. And so Pat Roberts end up saying, well, in particular, Gingrich ends up saying, okay, we're going to punish these members because it was Republicans who voted against it to protect their own interests. We're going to punish these members for doing that. And so we'll eventually gets it through, and they get through freedom to farm. And of course, what ends up happening there is that the priorities change, because one of those four or so members who wanted to sort of stop freedom to farm ends up being the chair of agriculture the next time the farm bill comes up, and is able to sort of essentially keep the system as he wants it. But it ends up being sort of I think to some extent, really a lot of the story here is about not just about sort of the individual members, but also that the power of the structures that can either keep members from doing things or the ones that they're able to overcome.
And there are a lot of different institutions. It is the sort of institutional structure of Congress, and mm-hmm. and how committees work and who's in charge and so forth. But you talk about so many other dimensions. Before we get into the case studies, because I want to get into the case studies, can you talk about when we're sort of thinking about this leadership, the issue evolutions themselves, particularly the role of the media and how members can access the media? And now it's even more so with social media, but that's not the focus of your book. And also this access to information, which I found really interesting to think about. Can you talk about those sort of threads in this whole story?
Yeah, because there are really, I think, to some extent, a whole bunch of different actors who are playing this sort of role in the outside that then really ends up translating into the inside. So, of course, you have your leaders and you have your media, you have your sort of leaders, the people who are going to be normally turned to, and then you have your other members. Now, media is looking for stories. So the media motivations and the congressional motivations are going to be different but similar in the sense that they're trying to sort of, that media wants to write the story, members of Congress want their story to be told, but media also is going to be looking for different threads, different ways to tell that larger story. And I think to some extent that's where you see these other members be able to come in. And the big difference is, okay, so if this is not getting a lot of coverage, you're not going to need to tell those other stories because it's not really exciting. This isn't going to drive media coverage. This isn't going to drive sort of the increased coverage. Whereas if it's something where you're getting, where you see more or in some cases increase in coverage, yeah, now you want those other perspectives. Now you want to know, okay, so we've got the leaders, but what about these other people? And to some extent, then that is going to translate into activity on the inside because for these members, it's saying, okay, we can not only sort of talk to media, we can also use our activities in Congress to push things forward. We could say, okay, let's introduce these bills. Let's introduce these amendments. Whatever it happens to be, under what circumstances, we have these ways of pushing this on our own terms. And I think to some extent, the story here really is that media, and I think to some extent, social media is, and I kind of begin to talk about at the end of the book that social media is going to make this even stronger. Of course, as we know, it's probably not necessarily policy focused per se, but basically that sort of ability for leaders to control this process is dropping, and it's dropping significant. If it hasn't already completely dropped out, it's dropping even further. And so for leaders, then it's even more so than it was before that they are having these issues in terms of keeping control of the situation.
And again, the title of the book is The Politics of Herding Cats. And so the sort of role of the congressional leaders has always been one, you know, when I talk about it in class, obviously you compare it to a parliamentary system, particularly Westminster, and it is so far apart in terms of like what you have that you can use as a leader. And what your book is really talking about is that so much of that is fraying, that it's really hard to see what capacity leaders do have in terms of managing their rank and file members to get them to do what they want. Mm-hmm. And of course, you start out with the healthcare debate among the Republicans trying to repeal the ACA. And so you have the healthcare debate as one of the case studies, agriculture as another one, and immigration as kind of the in between, the Aristotelian medium. And so can you talk about why these three case studies kind of highlight what you're trying to get at in terms of congressional behavior?
Absolutely. So when I was thinking about the design for the book and when I was thinking about what I wanted to show, I felt like there were three different ways I wanted to show this at work. I essentially wanted to show the situation where leaders win out, where leaders are going to have control of the system. And that's going to be your low coverage issues, something like an agricultural subsidies, where really, I mean, unless we're talking about sort of like, unless something, and in fact, it's, I mean, the largest sort of drive in the period I look at between 76 and 2016 has nothing to do, well, somewhat to do with Congress a little bit, but really to some extent, nothing to do with Congress in that it's the creation of Farm Aid, or the Farm Aid concert. And so to some extent, most of the coverage is not even happening. Congress is able to kind of do its own thing on that. With immigration, I wanted something where we saw change. And so immigration, you have that sort of 1980s coverage, but not a lot of coverage. A lot of this is allowed to happen sort of behind closed doors. a lot of the conflict is actually happening between leaders. And the only reason things don't happen in 82 or 84 is not because of sort of individual members pushing things, but because leaders are doing most of the heavy lifting. And so it's a leader-dominated discussion. You get to the 2000s, you get to sort of the 90s, that begins to break down. You get to the 2000s, it breaks down even further. And by 2010s, and of course, obviously, we can even take this into the 2020s, but by the time you get to the 2010s, basically, immigration is the sort of issue where you have people running presidential campaigns on it and trying to do certain things. I mean, I think one of the sort of things I mentioned in passing in the book, I think I mentioned it, is that by the time you get to 2013, you get the Gang of Eight. And this is not, like, you go back to 86, it's negotiations between the House and Senate subcommittee chairs on immigration. And maybe you've got judiciary in the background. And that's where most of the discussion is. By the time you get to 2013, you have Marco Rubio going on all four Sunday morning shows on the same morning to push the Gang of Eight deal and basically build his national profile. So the nature of the issue changed. And one of the things I wanted to make sure I was able to show was that as that nature changes, your ability to control the issue as leaders basically drops out. And then in that final piece with healthcare, it's the situation where we're always talking about it. It's that sort of central issue of American politics and sort of that sort of question here of sort of, okay, so when can leaders actually change this? And to some extent, you have to have every piece of every single circumstance come up exactly right. If the Democrats in the Senate don't vote on what ends up being the ACA before the election of Scott Brown, you've got nothing. If Jay Inslee doesn't have some extended discussion of his kitchen renovation to sort of rile up the House members to go back in and vote for the Senate bill, this doesn't happen. To some extent, everything has to line up perfectly. Every little piece and what ends up happening and why 09 is so sort of significant there is all those pieces lined up. 93, there wasn't really much of an attempt to line things up because Clinton really doesn't do anything until the end of the year. And by that point, everybody's already decided, hey, this is the version I want to do. And nobody does anything. In 2017, you end up with a process where the House gets something through after massive amounts of sort of back and forth. But the Senate doesn't want to take on the House's thing. And so by the time you get that midnight vote from John McCain, the whole purpose is kind of dropped out. And just as in sort of 09, unlike in 09, sort of 17, the election of Doug Jones probably puts a sort of final pin into all this. So it's like, so I think to some extent it's a story of very little coverage and sort of how leaders can control that change and sort of how leadership power breaks down. And even under the most extreme circumstances, you do see a win, but it's kind of the exception to the rule in the case of healthcare.
And one of the sort of points that you pay a lot of attention to, so the book is about congressional behavior, but it's really about the way that the media works in Congress and with Congress and possibly against Congress. But it is a story about Congress and congressional behavior, but it is also very much a story about the media. Can you explain about not only the media as a player in this, but your attention in the book to newspapers as opposed to other forms of the media?
Absolutely. So I'd say to kind of answer the first question related to sort of the role of the news media here, it really is about that. It's that sort of matching up of coverage with sort of things that the stories that they want to be able to tell, the stories that they want to focus on. These are the priorities. And to some extent in the cases I end up choosing, a lot of it, you have sort of things that are being driven by events. You have things that are being driven by congressional activity, but then there's some things that just aren't being driven at all. And so to some extent, seeing what media wants to cover, what they don't, and then who gets kind of created out of that to some extent in terms of the individuals who are able to sort of act on that, because it ends up being a situation where it's, you do have some people who are able to use that to their advantage, especially on the congressional end. And so they're the easy ones to go back to. The Tom Tancredos. Tom Tancredo immediately comes to mind as someone who built a presidential run and a gubernatorial run around how he was covered, and sort of that coverage of him as a sort of stalwart against many of the efforts on immigration and immigration reform. So I think to some extent it's, for media, it's not only seeking out the stories, it's also seeking out the people. Now, the newspaper choice, I think to some extent I wanted something where there would be at least some level of access that everyone would, including sort of the backbenchers, would have a level of access to, but also in particular something where everyone would theoretically want to, and again, I mean, there are some members that probably never want to get covered, but to some extent, having something where all members would have that sort of equal opportunity. And that's in particular why I chose the Washington Post, because the Post, it's the newspaper probably that's going to focus theoretically the most on Congress. It's the newspaper that's going to spend the most time probably on congressional activity. And so to some extent, it's not only just about letting people know at home, it's really also signaling to other members of Congress what's important. It's also signaling your priorities. It's signaling to stakeholders and policymakers and others who are making these decisions that what is important and that, hey, I am important. And so I think to some extent, because there would be sort of limited space in particular with something like, say, television. I'd been working on some other stuff with sort of television-related focus. And really the thing is that it's, I think television in particular, it's just a little bit hard. It's just harder to get on because you have, whereas newspaper, I think you have more space. TV, it's going to be that much harder. And of course, social media, I think, is the next stage in this discussion because it is to some extent the next place where we're going to see this sort of massive expansion.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And in terms of that, the role of the media, as you say, that the media is, and particularly the Washington Post or the newspaper, they're covering the policy, but they're also covering the individual. And again, this goes back to some degree to the framers' understanding of like a House member might want to move to the Senate or a senator might want to run for president. And Madison was very aware of that and wrote about that. How does all of that, the individual's ambition, counteracting ambition, come into play in terms of either pushing policy forward or also trying to stop policy?
I think that absolutely plays a major role. I unfortunately don't spend a lot of time trying to sort of tease out the different motivations just because it would just be, that's a whole other project altogether. But it is, I mean, looking at some of the members who end up part of, especially sort of the high coverage topics, a lot of these members are people who eventually do sort of move up and do run for president. I mean, you look at immigration and you've got, let's see. So especially in the 05 debate, 05, 06 debate, you've got John McCain as a central actor there who'd already run for president, obviously, but was working with Ted Kennedy at that point. You've got Tom Tancredo. You've got Duncan Hunter Sr., who also ends up running for president, sort of getting into this immigration discussion. And you see it in other places, too. I mean, and members of Congress end up trying to use especially these issues as ways to sort of define themselves and move themselves forward. I mean, just from sort of an anecdotal sense, I remember just going through my data. I think it was Alan Cranston in the 80s talking about nuclear war and trying to use that. Richard Lugar tries to use agricultural subsidies. Neither one of these, of course, ends up going too far, but it is this sort of, I think there is to some extent, there's this connection between individuals trying to sort of use that notoriety, whether that using that notoriety to run for president or sort of running for some level of higher office. And I think to some extent there's definitely a lot of that at work in this larger piece, because again, it is sort of that opportunity to sort of use this as your stepping stone to higher office.
One of the questions that I had for you as I was reading through the book is you do this time, the time period. So the beginning of the Carter administration, essentially through the end of the Trump administration. Can you explain to listeners why you look at that sort of period of time? What is it that sort of bookends it or confines it to that space? And what did you find in looking at that 1977 to 2020?
So there are two different sort of reasons I use that. One is just sort of data limitations, and which is just basically the most of the data started in 77, but it actually ends up working out very well in terms of being able to look at sort of these very different periods of sort of control. So you have pretty much every possible way to look at control that happens during this period, whether it's sort of, you've got that sort of start point of full Democratic government, and then you get Republicans control the Senate and have the presidency, and then you get the full sort of divided government, and then you keep going through this, and it's, you've got divided government, you sometimes have unified government, you have the Jim Jeffords switch, changing the government midway through 2001. You have all these different ways to look at sort of governing structure. So it's not necessarily being driven by one group being perpetually in the majority or minority. It really is all of these different groups and all of these different sort of structures of leadership that are constantly changing. And so to some extent, your backbencher one day, your sort of minority backbencher one day might be in the majority. And so to some extent, does that change? Well, I don't end up getting a good sense to sort of look at all that, but it is part of that larger story that maybe now that you're in the majority, that's going to change maybe how you seek things out and your long-term prospects. And so really with the sort of the time period, I wanted to be able to look at all these different eras and really be able to say, okay, so you have the 70s, and then it takes us up to right around when we really begin to see the development of media moving away from sort of this traditional media focus, which again, they're still going to these, but moving into the social media.
And in terms of what you saw, is there a distinction between the way that Republicans operated and the way that Democrats operated?
Not that I can think of offhand. I mean, I think the overall motivations are there. I think there are definitely situations where you see some leaders definitely having different levels of control over their caucus to some extent. I mean, I would say, for example, like John Boehner knew when to get out, essentially. John Boehner knew at what point he was going to completely lose control of his caucus. And so he said, okay, I'm going to get out of this now. Whereas I think to some extent, I mean, at the end, I didn't really see any sort of, I think the major things, if we're thinking about changes, happen as a result of sort of the general changes we see in the parties during that period, more than anything like sort of differences between the two. And that's in terms of sort of how they, that sort of leadership caucus piece.
And what you saw and what we see during this period of time is that the parties themselves become more ideologically consistent internally. So mm-hmm. The caucus in the Democratic caucus or the Republican caucus in the House or the Senate makes sense ideologically in a way that it hadn't before. But this is also when you see these periods where, as you note, John Boehner had a tough time holding his caucus together. And there's constantly comments about whether Nancy Pelosi can hold her caucus together. So is the ideological consistency inside the party also a problem?
I mean, to some extent, I think that it to some extent, the I think it really depends on the circumstance. I think it really depends on whether, to some extent, just thinking about kind of the institutional structures, you theoretically know when you're bringing something to the floor, whether or not you've got the votes to do it. And you would, there are obviously exceptions to this. I mentioned the Good Lat 2 bill in the immigration chapter, where it's like, where they don't even get sort of they get close to, but not even half of the Republican votes on that. So to some extent, I think you know going in that you've got the votes versus don't have the votes. But at the same time, it is also, it definitely makes it that much harder for leaders because, you know, to some extent you have all this clamoring to do certain things, but if you know your caucus can't do it, if you know your caucus is not going to go forward with it, you push on it and then all of a sudden you don't have the votes, that just makes the situation look that much worse. And I think to some extent it ends up being that separation between what leaders know versus what people want. And so there's that sort of, so it gets into that sort of larger question. I think to some extent that if you do also sort of increase that attention to an issue as well, that can backfire on leaders because now all of a sudden, oh, the other members are going to talk about it and they disagree with the leader. So,
and again, the media is now here to amplify the voices of the members of the caucus. And it's not as if the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, when they were not ideologically consistent, had a lot of, you know, everybody rowing in the same direction sort of situation. So the sort of ideological consistency for me has been one of these points that I'm really paying attention to in terms of the evolution of how Congress works. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't necessarily mean it's working better or efficiently per se. Although I know it wasn't designed to work efficiently. So in terms of the role of the leaders in the rank and in relation to the rank and file, as you note, sometimes the leaders will kind of bring things forward when they know they've got everything lined up and it's going to work. And other times they bring stuff forward, but they maybe don't give their rank and file full information. How does that work?
Well, I think that ends up being sort of this, and I think healthcare is the thing I think of immediately when thinking about sort of not giving the whole story, because I think to some extent it is that you don't want those, you don't want that coalition to break down. And so we think about healthcare. I mean, obviously most of the Republicans wanted to get rid of the Affordable Care Act. The problem was, how do you do it? And so by hiding the bill, a lot of the story is keeping that so that, you know, that we have limited amount of time to talk about it. We have limited time to deal with it. It's going to be either we're voting on this or not. And I think to some extent that does play a major role here because it is something where for the leaders, they want to keep control of the situation. And by keeping quiet about it and keeping quiet about what's actually in the bill, that does sort of have an effect because on the one hand, it's saying, oh, well, you go back later, you go back in terms of times of election and you voted against this bill and your sort of primary constituency might turn around and say, hey, you voted against getting rid of the Affordable Care Act. What's up? And so I think to some extent, there's a larger role and story there in terms of the power, especially for leaders to keep that information away as well.
But you also note in the book throughout some of the discussion of these case studies is that, the members have other access to information. And so while Paul Ryan or a congressional leader can keep a bill under wraps, that it's still possible for members to get the information in some other way. Does that also impact the way that the leaders can operate?
Oh, absolutely. Because you can try to keep these things down, but I think the 2017 healthcare situation really sort of illustrates that you had the House bill hidden. You had the Senate bill hidden until it kind of came through. And what ended up happening was you eventually got a House bill through, but the Senate bill falls apart in dramatic fashion. And to some extent, it's because of that process. Now, I don't know if that happens today. I'm not sure sort of under different circumstances how that would work, but it does have that ability to backfire. And so while maybe you can keep it out of the limelight, To some extent, there's that question of whether the hiding makes it even more of an issue, because I believe it was both Steny Hoyer and Rand Paul were wandering the halls of the House looking for the House bill. And that means that now you not only have coverage of it, you've got coverage of it that is not particularly flattering, and coverage that is focused less on the actual particulars and more on the fact that they want to hide it, which doesn't look good for you. So,
And when we talk about leaders, mostly you're talking about, as we've been having in this conversation, the House and Senate leadership, minority and majority leadership. But part of your story is a bit about how the president does and doesn't influence and act in these particular cases and in general. Can you explain how the leaders interact with the president and the president interacts also with the rank and file, or doesn't?
I think this is also one of those cases where it depends from president to president as well, where you have sort of the sort of anecdotal stories, and going back to taxes, which I don't really talk about obviously in the book, but going back to taxes and Ronald Reagan bringing members of both parties and talking to them about the tax bills and whatnot, or sort of, I think there's a presidential style component to this that ends up playing a role in that larger context. And I think different presidents are going to do this in different ways, or did it in different ways. I mean, I think one of the things that worked for Obama that did not work for Clinton or Trump is that Obama, while there was that level of sort of letting Congress do its thing, did eventually, to some extent, make this his own and kind of came in and sort of the February 2010 discussions and whatnot, and kind of ended up cementing and really was maybe not necessarily part of the legislative process, but kind of put himself out there as sort of pushing for it. Whereas Clinton kind of stays out of it for most of 93. And by that point, again, it's like you've got sort of every member of Congress throwing in their version of how this should work. And Trump, for the most part, just waiting to see what's going to happen and what comes out, really just wanting the sort of larger sort of whatever it is. Whereas Obama kind of put himself there. And I think to some extent, when he did that, that's really what kind of pushed things over the top, because at that point it's like, okay, this is, we're going to own it for good or for ill. And Obama is going to own this for good or for ill. And so, I think to some extent that role and that part of that process is what, and there are many different things that kind of pushed it at the end, but that definitely helped in a way that the way Clinton and Trump approached it did not help them.
And so if we're talking about an understanding of how Congress works, which is, you know, a lot of what's going on here, can we forecast possibly the role that, now that, I mean, you talk about the social media towards the end of the book, and you mentioned Representative Ocasio-Cortez, but, you know, we also have now Marjorie Taylor Greene and Crenshaw, and, you know, sort of backbenchers, really, new reps who don't have high profile committee assignments or anything. What is their capacity, given your research, to sort of jump the line and be able to define themselves and policy?
So I think it's really the question of whether they use that towards a policy end. And I think to some extent, we're seeing an asymmetry to some extent within the two parties over this. Whereas I think like Representative Ocasio-Cortez and some of the other members who have been sort of pushing for issues on the Democratic side, Ayanna Pressley, Cori Bush, they've used these towards policy ends and kind of push for specific policy. Now, do they get what they want? Or not always. In fact, to some extent, it's always, I mean, you still have that large coalition and you still have, I mean, one of the advantages I think that Ocasio-Cortez has that many others don't is that she doesn't necessarily need, well, she doesn't depend on a lot of these sort of donor networks that mean that she can take all this time to talk about all these other issues and focus heavily on policy in a way that maybe some Democratic backbenchers can't, because they have to go make phone calls. And I think to some extent, that allows her to and her staff to really kind of define these issues and kind of move things forward. And so I think that you have that sort of on the one side, you have the Democratic members really pushing on policy. On the Republican side, there are definitely members who do this, but there's definite, I think a lot of what they end up doing is more things that Congress isn't necessarily going to deal with, or dealing with sort of social media as a way to boost their profiles, whether that's a boost to their profiles to sort of run for higher office or get a job at Fox News, or I mean, in some cases, to some extent, sort of impress various people. I mean, it's kind of all over the place, but I think there's a definite asymmetry there. Now, this is, however, the way I think to some extent we're going to see members push for policy moving forward, is that you have this avenue, you have this ability to sort of reach these people very easily. You don't need the media anymore to do that, and it's going to be unfiltered. Now, at the same time, you're still going to have the filter that if media is going to cover it, they're going to cover it on their own terms, but you at least have that unfiltered way to immediately reach individuals. And I think to some extent, that's the next step here. Now, institutionally, there's still those things that are going to kind of hold things up anyways, but at the same time, that pressure is just going to get that much greater. And I think to some extent, we see this in terms of the Democrats at least beginning to move on things like the environment in ways that they hadn't probably recently. And we also see this in terms of the various kind of alliances and things that kind of come out of all this. I think about Representative Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey as a perfect example of sort of these alliances where kind of focusing on these issues means that you have also that House-Senate dynamic at work as well. So I think there's a lot, and I think social media is where a lot of this is going. And I think my book is really kind of speaking to where we've been and giving an idea of where we've been really informs to some extent where we're going.
So it is, I mean, the story in your book is that there is the capacity of individual members, House and Senate, to speak and to emphasize and to potentially move policy forward in some form. And not just have a Speaker of the House or the Senate Majority Leader being in charge of everything with a very strong hold. And so I think you're right that social media is the next quagmire with regard to what happens next in this story. So given that, John, can you tell me what you're working on now?
Well, let's see. I just had a paper accepted at American Politics Research with John Curiel, who is moving on to Ohio Northern University, and Devin Christensen, where we're looking at the role of Donald Trump's Twitter in terms of sort of how that sort of the types of messages that are getting out and sort of what messages get engagement, what messages get media coverage, that sort of stuff. We just had that come out. Beyond that, at the moment, I'm kind of in the middle of sort of transitioning through various things right now. One of the things I mentioned in the acknowledgments is that, of course, I wrote this whole book as a non-tenure track professor. And I'm moving away from that life at this point and trying to sort of figure out what's next. What that is, I'm not sure. I like research. I've liked teaching. I've liked all these different things. I think to some extent it's kind of figuring out what's next in that. It's a lot of applications, but it's also sort of a interesting change in this larger process. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Thank you, John Lovett, for joining me today on the New Books Network to talk about The Politics of Herding Cats, When Congressional Leaders Fail, published by University of Michigan Press in 2021. I assume one can buy this from the University of Michigan Press website. Is there a brick and mortar store with an online presence to which you would like to give a shout out?
I don't think they have my book, but there is a really cool little bookshop in Winston-Salem that's Bookmarks, which is attached to a little cafe, Footnotes, which is in the downtown area of Winston-Salem. It's right next to the Foothills Brewer Pub. Great little place. They've got a whole bunch of books and everything else, and great selection. They don't have my book, but that's okay. It is a nice little place, and it's a cool place. And that's a good place.
Okay, and they may be able to order your book if somebody accesses them online.
Absolutely. That's in downtown Winston-Salem, 4th Street, Right next to the Foothills Brew Pub.
Great. Thanks so much for joining me today, John.
No problem. Thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity.